This is Arab Talk on KPOO 89.5 FM in San Francisco. This is Arab Talk with Jess and Jamal. I'm Jess Hannam.
And I'm Jamal Dajani.
Jamal, the situation in Gaza continues to deteriorate substantially. According to the World Food Program, Oxfam, and the WHO, over 30% of Palestinian children are experiencing acute famine. And hundreds of Palestinian children have died from famine, acute famine, as we speak. Israel continues to deny access in an easy way for food, water, and medicine. We, in the last 24 hours, have noted that some of the shipments from Cyprus, with the help of the World Food Kitchen, have started to arrive in Gaza, but that still is not the best or most efficient way to get food into the starving 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza. Within the fifth month, the world continues to let Israel starve Palestinians to death. The situation is grave. Palestinians continue to be killed by Israel when they try to access the food that is being brought in. The situation remains catastrophic. 31,000 Palestinians have died, and it looks like negotiations for a ceasefire will continue in Qatar today. It is a profoundly moving Ramadan for Palestinians in Gaza today, Jamal. And we have quite a number of stories to cover today, including a number of recent attacks, frankly, on the state of Israel, on the apartheid state, on Netanyahu, including English director Jonathan Glazer, who called for an end of Israel's genocidal war against Palestinians. He even renounced his Jewishness to be used in the service of co-opting the Holocaust. He's been getting a lot of pushback. We're going to be covering that. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who is the highest-ranking Jewish American in the history of the Congress, also called on Israel to hold new elections and said that Netanyahu has lost his way. Again, tremendous backlash coming from Chuck Schumer's comments. And in another interesting story, we're going to cover all of the hoopla around trying to get rid of TikTok, Jamal. And, you know, there's a hidden story about why people are calling for an end to TikTok. We'll be covering that. But before we get to that, we're going to talk to the special rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, on the situation of the human rights abuses in occupied Palestine, including Gaza. And she says that arms embargo and economic sanctions on the apartheid state is the only way to stop the genocide. It's a very profound interview.
That's right. And I should add that the special rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, will be releasing a new report on the situation in Gaza. And that should be coming within the next few days, and we'll be able to discuss her findings. But let's watch Francesca Albanese. Muslims across the world have started observing the month of Ramadan, yet 2.2 million Palestinians are now suffering from extreme famine in Gaza. Very little food is trickling in, and when desperate Palestinians gather to get it, they are shot at by the Israeli military. Millions of people around the globe are demonstrating in the streets demanding a permanent ceasefire and an end to the carnage. Yet Israel and the United States, which continues to fast-track arms to it and veto United Nations Security Council resolutions calling for a ceasefire, are prolonging the agony of the Palestinians trapped in Gaza. Joining us on Arab Talk this week is Francesca Albanese. She's the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the occupied Palestinian territories. She recently stated that arms embargo and economic sanctions on Israel are the only way to stop the genocide in Gaza. Ms. Albanese is a lawyer who specializes in international law. She previously worked for a decade as a human rights expert for the United Nations, including the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights and the Relief and Work Agency for Palestine Refugees. She has published widely on the legal situation in Israel-Palestine. Her first book, released in 2020, Palestinian Refugees in International Law offers a comprehensive legal analysis of the situation of Palestinian refugees from its origins to modern-day reality. Welcome back to Arab Talk, Ms. Albanese.
Thank you very much for having me.
Last week, a delegation of Palestinians met with Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the United Nations. Our guest last week, Dr. Rula Al-Farra, was in this delegation. Since October 7, Israel has murdered more than 150 members of her extended family in Gaza. Guterres stated he was horrified. It was in this context you stated that arms embargo and economic sanctions on Israel are the only way to stop the genocide in Gaza. What made you come to this conclusion, and what makes you think it will even work?
Well, I think my comment is to be read first and foremost in the context of the ICJ interim order that requested a number of measures to be taken by Israel, but they are also they also refer to obligations for member states, because that under the Genocide Convention, the obligation to prevent and punish genocide is an erga omnes obligation. It's upon everyone who has knowledge and then is obliged to take effective measures to this end, to prevent genocide, first and foremost. And none of these measures have been observed and have been abided by Israel. Therefore, there is no other way than exploring other measures imposed by the UN Charter itself, which are economic, political, and diplomatic measures. And first and foremost, an arms embargo, because this is what Israel is using to carry out its onslaught on Gaza.
So the U.S. is now, of course, we've mentioned this, fast-tracking Israel weapons and money nonstop, which makes really the Israel's carnage possible. But then Biden says he has no leverage over Netanyahu to force him to let the aid in to Gaza. He's been resorting to airdrops and is now talking about building a costly pier in the Mediterranean to bring food in. As you are aware, there are more than 2,000 trucks of aid lined up ready to deliver food. Is this a delay tactic or is it something else?
Whatever it is, it's a clear violation of international law, which imposes obligations upon warring parties to ensure effective access of humanitarian relief to civilians in situation of armed conflict. And all the more, once again, the ICJ has requested Israel to take immediate and effective measures to enable the provisions of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance to address the adverse conditions of life faced by the Palestinians in Gaza. In the face of these obligations, there is no choice. And there is a need to let enter everything that is needed to address the adverse conditions of life, meaning the conditions of life that have been made impossible by 5 months plus military assault on Gaza, 5 months during which 70% of the civilian infrastructure has been destroyed, which includes the arable land and the fishing float of people in Gaza. So they can't even resort to life-sustaining options that are available in Gaza. So there is simply no food, let alone essential supplies to make hospitals work, the hospitals that have not been destroyed. So in the face of all this, it's so welcome to have a maritime corridor between Cyprus and Gaza to deliver much needed humanitarian aid to the north, which has been completely isolated, the northern Gaza, and to the south. And at the same time, it cannot, I mean, this is just a drop in the ocean if the crossings are not open. Rafah has not been functioning as it should. And as you say, there are thousands of trucks which have been stopped there for months now. They should be allowed in. But also the other crossing should be open. So this humanitarian siege must be lifted. I mean, the total siege that has been imposed on Gaza must be lifted, and a ceasefire is also needed. There are no ways out, and the rest will be a palliative that will not prevent death from starvation and famine. We have seen in recent days, in the recent week, 20, 25 people dying out of starvation, 16 kids. And this is just in the areas that are monitored by the UN, because we cannot say, we cannot determine how many people are dying out of famine in the northern Gaza. This is catastrophic, and there is no precedent of all these intertwined situations of abuse in recent history.
Well, I mean, since we're talking about the ICJ, the ICJ ruling stopped short of calling for a ceasefire, yet many legal minds think that if Israel abided by its ruling, it is tantamount to a ceasefire, because it couldn't keep doing the very things it's continuing to do without violating the stipulations. Is international law being tested and failing, or are people looking in the wrong place when they turn to international law in urgent situations like this? Or is the international law effective but just being selectively applied?
I've said before that I don't think that the problem is with international law per se, in the sense, like Philip Sand said before, the advocate Philip Sand said before the ICJ, no one in the room is starry-eyed about international law. So we know it's a limit. But here, it's not even that the limits have been tested. We are beyond what even violations of international law that we are used to could lead to. Because here there is a deliberate distortion of international law in order to kill people. This is my take on the situation, because Israel knows exactly what is happening. The conditions of life that are currently in Gaza are calculated. There is nothing that happens by a hazard or negligence. It's all happening within a plan. Now, the way the strikes are carried out, the way people are attacked, including while they try to assault out of despair the convoys, because they need food, they are starving, they need to feed their kids. And even then, they are killed. So I cannot say that this is just a loophole in the way international law or international mechanisms are functioning. It's a deliberate choice to misuse, to distort international law on the side of Israel.
You were one of the independent experts from the special procedures of the United Nations Human Rights Council, who recently signed a statement expressing alarm over credible allegations of egregious human rights violations that Israel's military has perpetrated and continues to perpetrate against Palestinian women and girls in Gaza and the West Bank. The allegations included, but were not limited to, denying women and girls sanitary pads, food, and medicine, keeping them in cages outside in the cold and rain without food, sexual assault, and extrajudicial killings of women and children. They also stated that an unknown number of Palestinian women and children, including girls, have disappeared in areas where the Israeli military invaded. Are investigations of these serious charges being undertaken, and can you talk about them?
Look, we were very careful on that statement because we are extremely concerned with the safety of the victims. So there are different layers of violence. And in that particular statement, we focus on the situation of women and girls. And there is, of course, the violence of the stemming from the living conditions that have been imposed on the Gaza Strip. The bombing, the chaos, the forced displacement, the lack of hospitals. So there is a general situation of violence, but also women have been subjected to specific forms of violence like arrest and detention. And I would like to say that the level of mistreatment, torture, and abuses in against Palestinians in Israeli prisons and detention centers is not new, but it's unprecedented in terms of proportion. So it's not necessarily the nature of the violation, it's the scale, is how widespread they they are. And they are not spared women. No, yes, indeed, there have been allegations reported to us of sexual assault and abuse cases, two cases of rapes. And it's very difficult to discern and to continue the investigations because the possibility to access Gaza are very, very limited, particularly the area in the north, which is under full Israeli control. No one can get in. And there is also a very limited way for the people in northern Gaza to communicate.
Also, aside from Gaza, all eyes, I mean, of course, are on Gaza. The conditions are so horrific. Yet the situation is also dire in the West Bank. There are ongoing pogroms by settlers. There are, you know, the conditions are worsening day by day. How are you able to keep informed of what is happening on the ground since Israel refuses to allow you into any part of the country?
Yes, it's been more difficult, but not impossible to get information using the usual channels. Before, for example, in Gaza, I could rely much more on a network of human rights defenders, human rights organizations, like the main ones still have people on the ground like Al-Mezan and PCHR, but their offices have been destroyed. So for them, and also because of mobility restrictions, it's all more difficult. I do rely on information provided or validated by the United Nations, but of course I also receive allegations from victims. I have a direct and very special channel of communication with children with whom I've worked last year for the production of my third report, and I keep on talking to them, although it's scattered. I cannot reach out to anyone who's in need, and the people in need cannot reach out to me as they used to. The situation is slightly different in the West Bank, where there is a different set of challenges and difficulties. There is no level of destruction that has taken place in the Gaza Strip. At the same time, there have been heightened mobility restrictions. So even for the Palestinian human rights organizations that normally document and report violations on a daily basis and with whom I have a regular contact, it has been more difficult to verify the information. I'm still in contact with Israeli organizations and others. But again, it's not a place, the West Bank and East Jerusalem is not a place where there is a lack of information and human rights defenders ready to provide it.
I mean, with what's going on in Gaza, is it these violations or investigations about these violations, have they been put on the back burner? I'm talking about from the sense from the United Nations and other agencies because of the catastrophe that is ongoing in Gaza.
Yes and no, Jamal, because for me, it's also part and parcel of what has been done to the Palestinian people as a whole. And I really push back on the fragmentation that has been imposed to the Palestinian by the occupation. So, for example, I hit the roof when I hear talking of the Palestinians in Gaza as the Gazawi, as if they were the population. No, so for me, I do see the heightened pressure and the heightened pressure on the Palestinian as a whole. I cannot investigate, but I do know and I'm aware of the violations that are being suffered by Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, meaning Palestinians inside Israel. It's just that I cannot document, I cannot write on those violations. But there is a tightening of the repression on all of them, including on Jewish Israeli citizens, who try to stand against this oppression, who ask for a ceasefire, who ask for a common basis of protection for everyone, regardless of ethnicity or religion. So it's the overall situation. And I wouldn't say, that the situation in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem has been put on the back burner. The only thing is that I try to explain settler colonialism as a phenomenon, of which what is happening in Gaza is the peak. And if we look at history, this is not an exception. Lemkin, who has given the word the the word, the term genocide is the one who coined the term genocide, used to speak of settler colonialism as quintessentially genocidal because it aims at the elimination of indigenous people through various methods of extermination, from ethnic cleansing, starvation, or killing. So there is a package. And then, of course, there is the crime of genocide as it is conceived in international law, which doesn't capture that cultural element, but still can explain in large part what is happening today.
I mean, things look very, very grim, but I have to ask this question from your vantage point. What development make you hopeful that Palestinians will receive justice, and what conditions make you more skeptical?
Let's start with the negative one. What makes me skeptical? I would have never, ever expected that in the face of what Israel has done in Gaza in the past 5 months, we could still face a wall of denial, a wall of defense of Israelis' policies. This is really shocking and disheartening. And it comes from the US, but also many European countries, the West in general, what I call the settler colonial club. And it's true, we have to face the reality that, as Omar Barghouti says, and I often quote him, 500 years of colonialism have left a huge imprint on Western societies. And we need to come to terms with that. So we cannot assess, we as Western people tend to create alibis or to create excuses, to create exceptions. But when it comes to, for our allies, but when it comes to international law, those double standards, that those areas of exceptionalism are incredibly dangerous because they undermine the very system that is there to protect us. And this is the only thing we have other than brutal force. So it's either this legal instrument. And, you know, I often say that international law is ineffective without political support. But political actions without the comfort of international law risk to be criminal. And this is what we are facing today. Now, moving to what makes me slightly hopeful. And there are many, many things. First of all, at the legal level, the courageous act of South Africa, that wonderful choice to take Israel to the ICJ for violation of the Genocide Convention was a watershed moment for all of us, because none of us has ever imagined to see Israel facing an international court. And yes, I know that the process will take a long time, will take years, but at the same time, it's very important also symbolically the fact that the ICJ has recognized jurisdiction, has not disregarded the case, has recognized the plausibility that Israel is committing genocide without even looking at the merit, just under this, I mean, limiting itself at looking at the surface, and has recommended interim measures that, if fully respected, would mean a de facto ceasefire. So I belong to those legal minds that do believe that full respect of the ICJ's measures would mean end of the assault. At the same time, I also see that there is an awakening at the global level of a social consciousness against injustice. The young generation is so much more capable, so much more mature than us, to link the dot, to make the connection between what's happening in Palestine and what happens to the rest of the world, including in Western societies. And this is something that really gives me hope.
We've talked about this in our last interview. You are under constant attack by Israel and its surrogates, including accusations of anti-Semitism. How do you cope with this and remain steadfast in advocating for Palestinians and underprivileged people?
Because they are underprivileged, because they are the victims right now. And I have nothing against Israel other than wanting Israel not to be an apartheid state. I have nothing against Israelis other than asking them to wake up and to realize what's happening in their name to the Palestinian people. I wanted it before the 7th of October, in fact. I wish there had never been a 7th of October because no one deserves what the Israelis have gone through. But again, no one deserves what the Palestinians have gone through. So this is what I have in mind all the time. I am attacked because of standing with the victims, standing on the side of justice. So frankly, it's annoying, but it's no more than an annoyance. It just sometimes it makes me waste time because I have to deal with the criticism. But again, it's about exposing also the false morale, the double standard, the ethical relativism of primarily Western countries, which I'm happy to do.
Francesca Albanese, thank you for coming on Arab Talk.
Thank you very much.
That's the voice in the face of Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights abuses in occupied Palestine. It's a very profound analysis that she's offering, Jamal, because she's basically saying Israel doesn't listen to the world, doesn't listen to international law, it gets away literally with murder, and that the only way to pressure or to get Israel to come in line with international human rights is through economic sanctions and embargoes. She's making quite a strong statement, but frankly, she's quite right.
She's absolutely right. And that's why, you know, if you ask many people who understand the situation on the ground, will tell you that President Biden can end this with one phone call. And they mean this, not this courting Netanyahu and blah, blah, blah. Just like saying, listen, if you don't listen to us, we're going to cut you off. I mean, that's the only way that's going to, that something's going to happen. And eventually it will in a different way, because Israel is a pariah state, because President Biden and others and Senator Schumer was warning about this and saying we don't want Israel to become a pariah state, but it is a pariah state.
It already
state.
Is.
It has been for a long time. And without the help of the United States, without U.S. aid, that cannot go on, but it's still going on. And every day, Palestinians are getting killed. They are being starved to death. But while we're on this topic, Israel just had two slaps in the face in 1 week, and
basically big slaps
by prominent Jewish people, starting with director Jonathan Glazer, as you've mentioned, who called for an end to Israel's genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza at the 96th Academy Awards. That was totally unexpected, because his film, you know, Glazer, he won the Best International Film Award for his film, The Zone of Interest, which is about the Holocaust, used his acceptance speech to speak out against Israeli occupation's hijacking of Jewishness and the Holocaust to fuel the war in Gaza. And I'm just using some of his words here, and I'm quoting, and he said, right now we stand here as men who refute our Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people. And just, you know, as we was expected,
The backlash.
After
right.
the speech went viral, I mean, you right. can go on the internet and see that clip millions of times, not thousands of times, but millions of times on social media. Glazer received severe backlash from AIPAC, the ADL,
everybody,
every single Zionist around the globe, saying that he renounced his Jewishness, which he didn't. They kind of like twisted his words. That he's a self-hating Jew, you know, the same story time and time again. He's an anti-Semite. I've seen all kinds of a traitor, a capo, using that word. And of course, millions also saw his humanity, Jess, and he was praised for being the only award recipient to speak about the onslaught in Gaza, and the plight of Palestinians living under Israeli occupation, although that's the other thing is also they were complaining about, is that this year's Academy Awards saw several celebrities, including singer Billie Eilish and actor Mark Ruffalo, actor Rami Youssef, Mahershala Ali, actor, all wearing the red pins in support of a ceasefire in Gaza. And meanwhile, there were demonstrators outside the Academy Awards, basically chanting, "Oscars, Oscars, shame on you, your hands are bloody too." And, it was a big shocker. That's, I would say, slap number one.
I think it was a big slap for many reasons, Jamal, and I just want to break it down briefly. One big slap, obviously, Jonathan Glazer, prominent British Jewish individual who had just won the Academy Award, won an Oscar for Best International Film. And not just any film, Jamal. You know, this film, which is a Holocaust-era film, The Zone of Interest. But if we understand what the film is about, it's even more profound, because the movie is about some German Nazis who live in this idyllic setting right next to a concentration camp. So while Jews are being exterminated, this Nazi Jewish family is living basically right next to it, in denial about the atrocities that are being committed. It wasn't lost on anybody, Jamal, especially Jonathan Glazer, that the symbolism of his movie in relation to what's happening in Gaza right now fits almost one-to-one. Here you have Israelis living in Tel Aviv and throughout, on the coast, in this so-called bubble of an idyllic setting facing the Mediterranean. And right next to them, a massacre is occurring, a genocide is occurring, a kind of modern day kind of ethnic cleansing of Palestinians right next door. And the Israelis are in complete denial about what's happening right across the street. So for Jonathan Glazer to say what he said, renouncing this, and renouncing the hijacking of the Holocaust to kind of engage in a modern-day genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in Gaza, was very profound by virtue of the fact of the film itself, Jamal, which speaks to the modern-day equivalent of what Nazis did living right next to a concentration camp. It's very compelling.
Very compelling, very powerful. And so the next slap came from Senator Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on Thursday, who called on Israel to hold new elections, saying that believes Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has lost his way and is an obstacle to peace in the region. Of course, amid the growing humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Jess, Schumer, the first Jewish majority leader in the Senate and the highest-ranking Jewish official in the U.S., basically went 180 degrees on Netanyahu and gave a 40-minute speech on Thursday morning on the Senate floor. And he went on to say that, the prime minister has put himself in a coalition of far-right extremists, naming Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, and as a result, he has been too willing to tolerate the civilian toll in Gaza, which is pushing support for Israel worldwide to historic lows. Israel cannot survive. That's what we talked about this earlier. He says, Israel cannot survive if it becomes a pariah.
Well,
and later
it
on,
already is a It already is a pariah, but yeah.
It is. It is. But later on, they went to Biden to ask him, what do you think about this? And he said, Biden, well, he agreed with Schumer.
He said it was a good speech.
Yeah, and he said it was a good speech. Well, yeah, he said he was a good speech. But remember, you know, Schumer is a vehement supporter of Israel. I mean, for a year, he has positioned himself as a strong ally, not only of Israel, but for every Israeli government, including Netanyahu. You know, visiting the country basically several times a year. He also visited Netanyahu also, like Biden, after October 7, and just to you know, flip on Netanyahu, and then just like that on a dime, that's a big deal.
Yeah, but honestly, Jamal, I don't think it's that big of a deal, and can I tell you why? The reason I don't think it's a big deal, because I think we have to be careful, because you said it in your analysis. You know, criticism of a single person, Benjamin Netanyahu, begs the question and kind of completely avoids the real issue here, which is the apartheid state of Israel itself. Because you said it, Schumer and Biden, who are gaslighting the entire world, by the way, by continuing to send bombs that are killing Palestinians, continuing to let the starvation of Palestinians happen on every single day. They're not condemning the apartheid state, Jamal. They're saying, oh, because of Netanyahu, we're worried that Israel is going to be a pariah state. Hey, listen, Netanyahu is not the problem. He is the symptom of the problem. It's an apartheid state. It's involved in genocide. It's involved in ethnic cleansing. It's a settler colonial project. And it's being supported by President Biden and the Congress and Chuck Schumer. So to say, oh, Netanyahu is the problem, really is a lot of political gaslighting, I think, because it takes us away from the reality of what the apartheid state of Israel is. As if, Jamal, if we get rid of Netanyahu, everything will be better. Does anybody really believe that?
No, you're correct about this. I think it's also a selfish reason, because they want to distance themselves from genocidal Netanyahu. Who wants to be connected to someone like Netanyahu? Because they know his end is near, and he's not going to, it's not, you know, the world is not going to be generous to him. Let's put it this way. And and now they want to distance themselves, starting with Schumer. He also has his own political ambition right here in the United States. And he's seeing on a daily basis the millions of people who are basically going out on in the streets and demonstrating, and people who pretty much interrupt every single politician who supported the genocide, you know, whether it's the President of the United States, VP Kamala Harris, congressmen, senators. You see that? I see videos of this on a daily basis. People are questioned and challenged about this issue. And it is also unpopular with a large number of Jewish voters in this country who reject what Israel has been doing. So he had to make a choice. Is he going to hitch his wagon to Netanyahu till the end, seeing 30,000 people getting massacred and the entire world is turning against Israel? Or is he going to kind of move either to the center or a little bit to the left and say, I reject that, but I do support the state of Israel. And also they want to see the survival of the state of Israel, because he said, I'm an ardent supporter of the state of Israel. And of course, they'd rather not see someone like Netanyahu, rather maybe replace him with Gantz or whatever, just kind of, you know.
But Jamal,
how good was it for Palestinians when you had the so-called peacenik camp, like
it was no different,
like Peres, you know, when he was prime minister.
It's all window dressing, Jamal. You and I know this. We've been talking about it for decades. The reality is, it kind of doesn't matter who the prime minister is of the apartheid state. It's just different window dressings. It's different flavors of the same flavor of apartheid. And I think it's just politically expedient for Schumer. It's politically expedient for Joe Biden and for Kamala Harris. And some of the politicians who've been, most politicians who've been supporting Israel unquestionably for so many years now, they see the writing on the wall. But let's not fool ourselves, Jamal. Biden and Harris and the Congress continue to support the ethnic cleansing and the genocide of Palestinians every day. We said it earlier today. Biden, with one phone call, could not only get a ceasefire, but could demand that aid come in through the land routes from Kerem Shalom or from Rafah. But that's not happening. So we have this inefficient, docking of ships, bringing in food, which is good, but nowhere near is going to be able to close the gap on the acute famine that Palestinians are experiencing now. So it's kind of BS. It's political theater. It's performative. People are making a big deal about this, about Schumer saying this. But frankly, Jamal, Schumer loves Israel. He's going to continue to support Israel. He's going to continue to support funding of Israel, even though they continue ethnic cleansing and genocide in Palestine. Okay? So let's be real about it. I don't really give Schumer or Biden that much credit, to be honest.
I agree with you. With one exception is that Netanyahu has become a liability. That's
politically,
that's the
yeah.
difference.
Yeah.
He's a political liability to Schumer Biden.
Yeah, but by the way, Jamal, and I know you read this, but I'll just say it. You know, some of the political analysis in Tel Aviv said that the Schumer talk actually helped Netanyahu.
So moving on to our next story, Jess, the House of Representatives passed legislation giving TikTok basically two choices. Find a buyer, and preferably an American buyer, or face nationwide ban in the U.S. And President Biden has indicated he would sign the law, but first it must clear the Senate, where it faces an uncertain future. This has been going on for a while, but somehow just it has accelerated in the past few days, calls for the ban on TikToks. And so what is the difference, in your opinion, this time?
Well, Jamal, I think the difference, if we scratch below the surface just a little bit, what is it about TikTok that is freaking everybody out? And one element of TikTok is that it's able to show the reality of what's happening on the ground in Gaza and in Palestine in ways that people are able to access information without the filters and the biases of the mainstream media. And it, frankly, is freaking a lot of people out, a lot of APEC supporters, a lot of pro-Israel supporters. TikTok, if you look at it in terms of the content showing the genocide in Palestine and what's happening in Gaza, is very deep and very profound. So to me, why aren't they calling a ban for Instagram or for Facebook? Or what is it about TikTok that is freaking everybody out? Seems kind of obvious to me. What do you think?
So you don't think it's about China spying on the United States, which I find it a little bit ludicrous. Because if they want to spy, then I believe China spies on the United States. I believe
but
Russia
they do
spies
anyways,
on the United
Jamal.
States. I believe yeah, Israel spies on the United States. But they don't need a TikTok to spy on the United States. And you hit the nail on the head. So here is basically the director of the ADL, the pro-Israel lobby, Jonathan Greenblatt, who said in a leaked phone call, "We really have a TikTok problem in the U.S. So the Anti-Defamation League CEO was speaking about the difficulty, basically, in controlling the narrative for young people. And I want to quote from his own words. This is recently has been leaked. Although he said similar things on MSNBC about a month ago. And he says, but I also want to point out that we have a major, major, major generational problem. All the polling that I've seen, ADL's polling, ICC's polling, independent polling, suggests that it is not a left or a right gap, folks. The issue in the United States, support for Israel, is not left and right. It is young and old. And the numbers of young people who think that Hamas's, massacre was justified is shockingly and terrifyingly high. And so we really have a TikTok problem, a Gen Z problem, that our community needs to put the same brains that gave us, I couldn't hear that, Tagli or something like this, the same brain that gave us all these other amazing innovations need to put our energy toward this like fast. Because again, like we've been chasing this left-right divide, it's the wrong game. The real game is the next generation, and the Hamas and their accomplices, the useful idiots in the West, are falling in line in ways that are terrifying. Those are the words of Greenblatt, basically blowing the alarm whistle. Just warning about TikTok and losing, and he thinks that this is how the lobby is losing Gen Z and the young people.
Well, here's
in
the difference,
United
Jamal.
States.
Yeah, and they're freaking out because young people get news unfiltered. Young people understand what's happening in Palestine. They're not being biased by the mainstream media and other print media, which is deeply biased, as we all know. But for me, the more important thing is like, and you know, you said it and I said it, this is not about spying. China spies, Israel spies on the United States, and it's not about TikTok. But the difference is, for example, with Facebook and Instagram, here's the difference. They've been slamming and shutting down pro-Palestinian accounts, pro-Palestine accounts on Facebook and Instagram every single day. We hear about it all the time. Pro-Palestine content is being moderated, is being throttled, and accounts are being shut down. They haven't been able to do that on TikTok yet, Jamal. So that's why they want to go after TikTok. They want Mnuchin, the former Treasury Secretary under Donald Trump, is putting together a group of investors to buy TikTok, theoretically. And you know what will happen. They're going to start throttling, controlling, and denying access to the content that people want. And you know, I hate to say this, Jamal, but Jonathan Greenblatt is probably right about one thing. The next generation sees Israel for what it is, a pariah apartheid state. And they have every reason to be concerned because people see the reality of Israel, not through the Hasbara eyes, but through the eyes of reality that these younger generation people are able to see. So you'll never hear me say that again, but I think Jonathan Greenblatt is right about that part.
You've been listening to Arab Talk on KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM. Go to our website, Arab Talk Radio, to download the latest shows, and we'll talk to you next week.
See you next week.